what to say this afternoon. As always, wondered about the usefulness of words in this context at all. Remembering Peter's way and his model with Koto Sawaki, and there's another way of doing this where we just sit and we don't speak at all. And I thought this afternoon, well, maybe it was the tree. I don't know whether it's a plum tree or a cherry tree. I've been told both. But that tree up there in the front yard was gray when we came here. And bumpy. Its twigs were bumpy. But it was very, very gray. And overnight, it turned red. Last night. If you look at it, you'll see it isn't blooming yet. The buds are all there, and the twigs the buds are on are all there, and they're all red. Just like that. And I thought, the rain is speaking to us continually in constant different voices. So many different ways it's saying, and so many different things it's saying. Sometimes it's fierce and wild, and sometimes it's almost a mist. Sometimes it comes straight down in great gouts of wet. And always making noise, always speaking. And that little creek, Peter's Creek, is having the ball right now. It doesn't always get a chance to do this, but it is having the best time. And the fire itself is speaking to us. You can hear it. It's hard to tell the fire from the water, but you can tell. So, it just seems to me like we're getting a Dharma talk constantly in wonderful ways. On the other hand, there is a reason, more than one reason, to give a Dharma talk in human language. And one of them is what I call iconoclastic. Iconoclastic means to break the icon. And iconoclasts are ones that break through conventional ideas and free up the mind, presumably, they hope, in some kind of often wild way. You could say those shrouded folks who blasted Oakland last week, broke all the windows and screamed and yelled at everybody, thought of themselves as iconoclasts. We're going to break through this whole thing and change everybody's mind. Zazen itself is iconoclastic. We come on the first day with our mind's already made up for a lot of things. We have to have made up minds. We have to have figured out a way to navigate through the day and the week. And yet, when we sit down and we don't have those things to do anymore, it all begins to break up in our mind. And our certitude breaks up in ways that can sometimes be alarming. Oh, I thought I really knew what this was. Now I'm not so sure. So you could say a Dharma talk is about encouraging the breaking up of ideas, encouraging the freedom that comes from looking once more at what we think we know, what we think we believe, what stories we've accepted as truth. Most everything that we believe is a story. Most everything that we count as truth is an agreed upon story that we all hope that we're sharing together. And it's based on trust, on trusting each other and trusting that we're sharing somehow the same ground of experience and understanding. The history of human life is about this, about how we gather together on the basis of some belief system, some myth often, and then it becomes discombobulated in some way, breaks up, and there's a revolution, and then there's a whole new flood of ideas happening that everybody then agrees on. They're based on believing. We believe these truths to be self-evident. The interesting thing about Buddhism is that it's not a belief system. It's, I don't know whether to call it an advance or a retreat from how human beings generally go about doing things. Buddha left it all up to us. Buddha said, I can't tell you how to think about things. I can tell you what happened to me. I can tell you what I did. But each person finds his own way. And each person's way is different. So you can't just model yourself on a great teacher like Buddha. And you can't take his ideas as an icon and hold it fast and believe it. Because then you're still in a state of tremendous dependency and uncertainty in a way that is far, far from the way things really are. The way things are is very plain, very simple. And although we have to have many ideas, complicated ideas about it in order to try to grok it the best we can, a great deal of it is about trusting ourselves, trusting our own intelligence, our own discriminating mind, our own wisdom. In the end, that's all we have. It's all we are. Little bundles of blood and bone and wisdom and compassion. What Buddha said was we get very confused if we think too much. But he didn't say, don't think. Dogen quoted another teacher as, in a very famous saying, think not thinking. How do you do that non-thinking? So great tomes have been written about this ever since, trying to analyze and figure out what the heck that means. It doesn't mean not to think. We do think. We think in Zazen. We think through things. We see through things. Our life passes through us as our mind is given nowhere to run away to. When we sit this way, we're stuck with ourselves. And it's a great opportunity, although it's very uncomfortable, physically and psychically sometimes, just to be with oneself and begin to see what our icons are, what we base our certainties on, our assumptions. As Russ said yesterday, we often think very badly of ourselves. That's one of our icons. We've just set ourselves up with this idea about this. Although, if we actually sat down and analyzed it, you wouldn't be able to say so one way or the other. This sitting is sometimes called Shikantaza, and a whole lot has been written about Shikantaza also. Many, many understandings. It means only just sitting. Shikan, only thus. Somewhere it says it means nailed down sitting, that you're stuck down, you can't get up, you can't run away, and you can see if you're all tangled up like this, you really can't get away. That was the first thing I discovered when I had to sit in a chair the first time. Oh, I could just stand right up and walk right out the door. Boom, just like that. It's a very different feeling. So that in itself is a very helpful consideration when you're sitting. You're really stuck. So try not to graduate to a chair. You're better off down there. But plain sitting does not mean that it is not your own complicatedness. Life itself, the universe itself, is a huge dynamic. We call it karma when we talk about all the energies that go into making each situation. Each action is based on so much else that comes into creating each situation. It's immeasurable. We can't talk about my karma and your karma the way we used to. It's too complicated for that. But we can experience it and honor it. and begin to explore. One thing I left out yesterday in talking about posture was how to find your center each time you begin to sit. And it's because I forget every time. I've been always very forgetful about this, and it's a mistake. Because knowing just where your physical center is helping you find your center in every way. And the only way to do that is to find it this way. You rock and get smaller and smaller until your body just naturally settles where it wants to be. And you can go backward and forward the same way until it settles just where it needs to be. And centering physically also helps us center mentally, you could say, psychically, because often our minds are leaping like rabbits from one subject to another, just here and there and then everywhere else. It's very hard to settle because there's so many things to think about. Or at least we like to think there are. Much of our thinking is just to distract us from our problems, our challenges, our ideas, especially about ourselves. So to find that center, and then just find a way to be quiet and rest. And many, many issues come up, but you can be quiet with the many issues. You can rest with them. It doesn't have to be a drama every single time. So in a way, you could say we're learning to break things up in order to quiet them down. It's a lifelong process. It's a day-long process. It's weeks and months, all the way up to the very end. And in some profound way, it's a mystery. If you try to put your finger on it, you can't. If you try to say it, you can't. It's like when we say, it's raining. What's it? Something's happening. We don't have to say. But we can feel tremendous gratitude and surprise and awe and appreciation, even as it's sometimes very confusing. So a steady rain is speaking now. Like it really means it. Sometimes it doesn't mean it. Just sort of by the way. This is one of those quiet ones, very determined. So that's what I brought this afternoon. You must have some things to add, Jerry.
Buddha encouraged experiments.
Mm-hmm.
And experiments and experience put bounds on what a story can be. Many topics are not easily capable of precise experiments. They're too complicated. But some things are. And ultimately, it's a matter of trust. I didn't do the experiment myself. But the results. And the narrative has to conform to those results.
Yes.
So there are facts and there are alternative facts.
Mm-hmm.
And it's dangerous to ignore the constraints on what a narrative can be.
It is dangerous. However, it's also we too easily tend to get stuck because of that. So it's a question of balance and almost instinct to tell which is the safe place to go and which is too far to go. And it changes. The situation changes through time, depending on what's been discovered. We've seen that over and over.
It tends to expand.
It does tend to.
It doesn't necessarily change in practical effect. So there are the stories we make up about who we are.
Mm-hmm.
Those are fairly unconstrained. But there's the temperature at which water boils. That doesn't change.
That's pretty strict. Yeah. And there's a lot in between.
A great deal in between.
Yes. And we're always working that out. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you. That's exactly what makes life so interesting. Endlessly. Russ?
Well, first off, at 9:40 I thought the meditation felt like it had gone quickly, so when I rang the bell, we went back to Kinhan, I realized the reason it was quick, because I had made it 10 minutes shorter. but anyway.
Good job!
The second one was 40 minutes to compensate, so if anyone felt a little disoriented. So you had suggested the smile, and I've been noticing that it really is, I've been experimenting with it, and it there is something very genuine in it, like, but then also some reactivity, so I've been, it's actually an interesting experiment to try to keep playing with smile. Like, it's different when I'm doing Kinhin or different on the cushion and struggling. It's, but, you know, as the other thing is that struck me when you're talking about icons as a Christian, you know, I've spent most of my life as a Christian until maybe the past decade, but I often thought of, you know, when you really wrestle with a religion, it strips you at the same time you strip it. And so when you mentioned icons, I feel like, you know, in Christianity, an icon is sort of a nonverbal image that's that somehow helps you connect to something. And I think when you said that, it's like I almost had that sense of like, I don't, even though these wouldn't be called icons, I don't really appreciate these religious, that they have something they're trying to help us reach in a nonverbal way. And so I guess that's the sort of sense that I have to not resist some of these icons or whatever you want to call those.
You mean the statues?
Right, yeah, the religious imagery and symbolism.
It is imagery and symbolism. Yeah. And that's why they say if you meet Buddha on the road, kill him. Right. So it's very necessary. We really do project some of our best qualities on best things and find ourselves that way. Find our goodness and our wisdom sometimes just in projecting on something that is good and wise. So it's not a bad thing. The bad thing is just grasping and holding something that needs to be let go. Because once you got there, you don't need it anymore. It's not about it, it's about you. So it's really just giving you back yourself in some way. All of our different ways of enacting in the Zendo as we bow and offer incense and the few things that we do that are forms are all about projecting in action what we're receiving and what we're expressing at the same time. So actually I want to talk about forms tomorrow because it's an important aspect of our practice and one that sometimes came to America and people just wanted to throw them all away. Oh, this is old-fashioned stuff. We're not going to do that anymore. So it's important to understand what it is and on what basis we can throw them away, you could say, and how important it is to keep them by us in some way because they serve so well. Yeah. Thank you. Jane?
I have two questions. The second one is short. So I think that, anyway, so the Meal Sutra, we consider whether our virtue and practice deserve it. I stumble over that because I feel that food is one of the things that everybody gets, even murderers. And so I've been thinking how else I would say that, and I came up with we reflect on our effort and practice and give thanks. Because I guess I don't like the deserve part.
Well, it's the same thing we do before we take the precepts. We say, all my ancient wrong actions arising from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion based on mind, speech, and body, I now avow. I now fully avow. So it's based on the knowledge that we are very imperfect creatures, and that it's helpful to bring ourselves down a peg or get off our high horse. That's what my father used to say. Annabelle, get off your high horse. So that tendency to I think we do deserve it, to think we're the cat's meow, we're the best, we're eating when people are starving all over the world. So it's not quite so sure whether we deserve it or not, in my book.
Of course that is true, and I guess what I'm thinking is that the whole point of fully avowing all my ancient wrongdoings is to say, yeah, I'm small, petty, and boring, or however you want to say it, or selfish, or deluded, or and the bodhisattva vow is a way of saying I accept that, and I embrace that, and I guess. I guess I'm thinking of ways that we can freshen the language. So, well, you know, in poetry, you try and make a language say something new, and you hear it a different way.
Well, Kobin always said we should rewrite everything. Rewrite the Heart Sutra, rewrite the Meal Sutra, rewrite it all. So, do it. You can do it. You're a poet.
Can I ask one more?
Yes.
So, if this mudra isn't available to you during Zazen, what are other mudras that we might do?
Holding your thumb, your right thumb, and wrapping your hand around your knuckles, and just holding it against your belly. Some people can only do it this way. Some people just can't accomplish this cosmic mudra, so-called. But this works. I have nerves that don't like this position a whole lot, so I switch from back and forth to different ways. Well, the hands aren't connected then. That's the main point. And actually the hands can be the lead to the focus, you could say. Dogen's teacher said, put your mind in your left hand when you're sitting. It's a way of encouraging people to drop out of their too much thinking and just rest it here, which is where the center actually is. The center you've already found.
Would you appreciate a comment on that?
Of course.
I have a statement more than a question.
Please.
When the meal chant comes, I'm kind of more old school when it comes to forms. And when I chant, when lunch happens, it's easy to forget that something died so I can live. That I'm taking that in the question, do I deserve this or not? You know, I wrestle with that question for a few years, and it's like, I owe this gratitude. I owe this life that's been given to me. You know, it's time to wake up and do something and move that forward in a way that makes it, just like when I give mine, I hope that something will come of it. So it comes and helps me to hear that in a very serious voice. You know, do I deserve this? And to answer that with, I'm grateful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something has to wake me up sometimes.
Well, the poor carrot, you know. Yeah. They pulled the poor carrot right out of the ground.
Never saw light.
No.
Part, except its hair.
So if we're going to eat that carrot, we better make a good thing out of it.
Yeah.
Oh, thanks, Joe. That's nice. Yeah. Jerry? Sure.
Liturgy is very interesting, and it develops in a rather polished way over a long period of time. Sometimes it needs to be changed, but usually there's a very good reason for each part of it. And whether it's true or not, strictly speaking, it may provide an avenue for your own feelings and some satisfaction to you that you may not be able to appreciate up front. I can think of a similar sort of thing. I'm a pretty thoroughgoing atheist. God in his various forms isn't a reality as far as I'm concerned. One can speak about it in tangential ways to give it meaning, but not in the usual sense. Nevertheless, there's a great deal, say of the Old Testament particularly, that has a great deal of meaning to me. And in one of the I think it's from one of the Psalms, I'm not sure, maybe one of the prophets. There's something that's similar to what Suzuki Roshi said about doing things. The people do things, they do it, but Buddha's left out.
Mm-hmm.
They don't do it. And so even for myself, it's satisfying to say, it's you who have made us and not we ourselves. And that has no literal reality for me. But it's a very important point.
It is the point. Did everybody hear that? The doing, this is in, the doing of
it is he who made us and not we ourselves.
The doer. The enactor. Yeah. Abandoning the self in a way, surrendering the self, which is what we do when we bow. It's the same at the altar.
Sounds so Christian.
Well,
in a good way.
It is Christian in a good way. It's every great teacher says the same thing. And it's not, again, we can't put our finger on it, so we get confused. Coben always said 50% God, 50% not God. He said, how can we say? We can't say. But we certainly have some sense of that we're not doing it ourselves, that it's through us, with us, by us, in us, for us. In a way that is really not reachable by words, which is why we have those funny stories, where the stories are pointing to something, and sometimes people say, oh, I get it, oh. And it isn't what it is, but it's pointing to it in a way that you kind of get it. Oh, yeah, it's raining. I see. You know, it's something's happening. And oh man, it's big. It's way bigger than we are. When I forgot to say something I was trying to say and I asked Tobin where the words went, he said, back where they went, back where they came from. There's a sort of came from place that we all know, but we couldn't say what it is. We can look in the eyes of a newborn baby and see it.
I guess because you were talking about throwing away, what was it, all of the practices or whatever, something or other. And I think that a lot of people, you know, they notice that I always walk out of the zendo before we do prostrations, might think, if you don't know me, that I'm just throwing away the practice just because I don't want to do it. And actually, my having the nerve to walk out of the zendo, it took a lot of nerve on my part. And it actually came after many, many, many years of struggling with that activity. You know, it didn't just come easily to finally decide, no, I can't do this anymore. When I first got into Buddhist practice, I mean, I was like really into all of it, you know, and I did all of it. I did it religiously and as well as I could and the whole thing. But then there came a point where my old religion kind of started coming back to me, and sometimes I would say to myself, well, I'm not really doing this, you know, and I realized I was teaching myself to lie, which kind of isn't the point. I mean, that was part of it, and then I just finally had to stop. So I guess I'm defending my little self. And I know someone once commented to me, and he said, when he first, it was during this, she saw me leaving, and he was very angry that I would do that, and then it took him a few days to finally come to terms with the fact that I was leaving. I mean, this was without conversation, and that it was okay. So I just wanted to mention that it's not lightly that I leave. It's not likely that I keep coming, either.
Well, many people practice more than one religion. They practice a religion and practice Zen also and see no problem with it.
Well, see, right back then, all my Zen friends would say, well, it's fine, you know.
Yeah.
But I was afraid to ever mention it, you know, in Jewish circles. But then suddenly discovered, totally by accident, that a lot of people were doing Buddhist practice. It was a big surprise to me. And so things have changed a lot. But even so, for me personally, so I feel okay with coming here or talking about it, but I still don't feel comfortable doing frustrations. I mean, that is
such a major no-no. I mean, great rabbis have died because they didn't want to look like they were doing prostrations. You know, we learn these stories at a young age. You know, they didn't want to look like they were bowing to the king. You know, some king really loved this one rabbi, and he said, well, just, you know, bend down and tie your shoelaces, you know, while you're standing in front of me, so it'll look like you're bowing. And he wouldn't do it because, as a great rabbi, he didn't want to set that example. So these are the stories we learn. So I can't do it.
It's hardwired.
It was made into hardwired.
It's hard when you don't throw your shoes, the laces in the zen, but you can't bow down and tie your shoes.
I can clean my toenails. But thanks for the idea, Peter. So I guess with Gassho, I feel a little different because, you know, we're just sort of acknowledging each other. And I can accept that. It's different from bowing to the Buddha.
So in your mind, it's bowing to the Buddha.
Well, and whoever, I just was abbreviating it.
I see. Yeah.
But just doing any prostrations, whatever. Whatever we're doing in prostrations,
right.
The only thing we can do prostrations to is our God. Not your God, not that God.
Yeah.
Not you, not us.
Peter?
Thanks for reminding us that Buddha said there is nothing he can teach us what to do, what to believe. That it's very individual. We have to find our way. But we come across teacher or teachers in our life that help us to do it, but it's still our way that teacher is helping us with. When you do that for decades and decades, so you can come to a point where it feels okay. You know, you said to kill the Buddha, you know, you find him on the road. Sometimes you kill the teacher too, and you break away. And what does it take to know that point? Does it, the teacher say, "You killed me. You know, I'm dead. You don't need me anymore. I'm gone." And I'm sure this is different for everybody. I'm just. Think out loud here that at some point everyone breaks away from the forms and the rituals and the teacher and really does sense that this I is found the way for me, and I'm comfortable with that. And I can practice this way that I've found with the teachers that have come along in my life. I'm not sure if that's a question or just a statement, but maybe it points a little bit to what Jerry said about, you know, there's some dangers in that because there's some things that are fluid, like who am I, and other things that you've got to follow rules, or they're set by the nameless of the universe. So once again, I'm leaving you with not much, maybe I'm not, there's no question here, just my rambling, but the rambling was set off by you reminding us about Buddha's telling us where he didn't give us the way, we have to find it ourselves.
That's right, but there is, depending on you and your teacher, there can be a connection that is so alive that it doesn't matter what happens between you, it's still there. It's it's called Menju, face-to-face transmission, which has nothing to do with getting a brown robe or anything. It's just how you're able to meet not only a teacher, but the grass on the road, the next person that you meet, that there's a way of being in the world that is meeting, that is being with your teacher all the time, having met your teacher. It's a connection that you make that is for always. So it isn't a social thing. It isn't it isn't a religious thing. It isn't part of the organization or the infrastructure or the... It's not an organized thing. It's just person to person, which is what Buddha was for people. One by one by one. When he was finished under the tree, he thought maybe somebody else would get it. And so he went to find his friends and began a 50 years process, 40 years of going out and meeting people and being with them. We call that now saving all sentient beings. It's a way to live, to offer the connection. So if you've met that connection, then there's no question about breaking or not breaking. There can be drama around it. I mean, you may never see her or him again, but that doesn't change anything. Death doesn't change anything.